This Washington Post Live podcast is sponsored by AstraZeneca, a science-led biopharmaceutical company dedicated to partnering with leading scientific companies, organizations, and the community to improve outcomes for cancer patients.
You're listening to a podcast from Washington Post Live, bringing the Post's newsroom to life on stage. On Tuesday, November 13th, entrepreneur and philanthropist Sean Parker, FDA Commissioner Scott Gottlieb, and famed oncologists Ned Sharpless, Douglas Lowy, and Zeke Emanuel discussed advances in cancer detection and treatment at the Washington Post's third annual Chasing Cancer Summit. In this segment, doctors and medical experts discuss the rising HPV-related cancer rates in the United States and how doctors are looking to treat and eradicate these preventable cancers. Let's listen.
Morning. I'm Lenny Bernstein. I'm a health and medicine reporter here at the Washington Post. And I'm joined by on stage by three of the titans of the cancer community. Dr. Douglas Lowy, Deputy Director of the National Cancer Institute. Dr. Maura Gilson, Professor at the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center. And Dr. Akila Viswanathan, who's the Executive Vice Chair of the Johns Hopkins Radiation Oncology and Molecular Radiation Sciences Division. And one of the titans of the journalism community, Steve Hendricks, who has an experience with this disease and has written a story for the Post about it, and we'll get to that. I want to let you know that if you have questions, you can tweet them, and they will be passed on to me, and I'll ask them. HPV cancers, according to CDC data, have risen from about to about 42,700 in 2015, more among women than among men, but we're going to have our panel discuss all of that. Dr. Gillison, can you just outline the scope of this problem for us? It's a type of cancer probably that many people are not familiar with.
Sure. So first of all, HPV is necessary for the development of about 4.5% of the worldwide cancer burden each year. That's approximately 630,000 cases. Most of those cases worldwide are cervical cancer. 83% are cervical cancers in women, largely in low and middle income countries. Unfortunately, in the United States and other developed countries, cervical cancer incidence has declined dramatically over the last five decades as a consequence of effective screening programs. What has happened, therefore, in developed countries such as the US is unscreened HPV-caused cancers have increased over the last several decades. The burden of HPV-caused cancers in the United States over the last decade has switched from women to men. There are more HPV-caused throat cancers among men in the United States than there are cervical cancers among women now.
So has screening fallen off? Are we just not doing as much as we did?
No, cervical cancers are the only HPV-caused cancers for which there are effective screening programs. Mm-hmm. The other anogenital cancers caused by HPV, vulvar, penile, anal cancers, are not routinely screened for, and there are no screening programs currently for HPV-caused throat cancers.
But we have a primary preventive, Dr. Viswanathan. We have a primary preventive vaccine.
That's right. So we not only have screening programs for women, but we do also have vaccination programs that have been approved for children starting at age 9 and now going up to age 45. But we have seen a decline worldwide of about 1% in cervical cancer and HPV-related malignancies as a result of that. But there's been mixed penetrance in terms of uptake of the vaccine. So, not everyone that's eligible for the vaccine, unfortunately, gets the vaccine. And that is a big problem, I think, that we need to address.
Dr. Lowy, why is that?
Well, I think that in terms of uptake of the vaccine, there really are multiple reasons why in the United States there has been less vaccine uptake. The Center for Disease Control says that there is provider hesitancy. The HPV vaccine is unusual in that the children of poor families actually have higher vaccine uptake than children of more well-to-do families. On the other hand, for when you think about oropharynx cancer and HPV, it's very important to recognize that while the vaccine is effective at dramatically reducing the risk of infection and ultimately of developing disease, most of the infections are occurring when people are relatively young, whereas the cancers are occurring usually when people are in their 50s. And so adults who are now, let's say, 40 or 50 years old are not going to benefit from the vaccine. The vaccine really is for the next generation rather than for the current generation of adults.
So many of us, most of us, will be exposed to the infection, but only a few of us will get the HPV-related cancers.
That's correct. I mean, for a woman, it's estimated that a woman's lifetime risk of acquiring a genital HPV infection is on the order of 75 to 80% to have at least one infection.
And men?
And men, probably comparable. Yes.
And then does it depend on your immune system, or why is it that few people?
Luckily, most people who are infected with HPV clear their infection. And when they clear their infection, the risk of developing a cancer at that site of infection also goes away for that infection. But they remain susceptible to infection by other types. And if they're cancer-causing types, then you need to worry about it. Again, the vaccine can prevent the majority of the infections that lead to cancer.
So then I guess the question becomes for the panel, why are so few people getting the vaccine?
Well,
is it the anti-vax movement?
Well,
where do we start?
First, I think that actually a lot more people now are getting the vaccine than was the case a few years ago. The latest data from the CDC suggests that about 60 to 65% of eligible 13 to 17-year-old teenagers are getting one dose, and about 40% are up to date. But in terms of the question, certainly people opposed to vaccines in general, that has been a concern. There's been a concern about safety, although the comprehensive review 2 years ago by the CDC said that the side effects of the HPV vaccine are that of side effects of other vaccines. So I think that another issue is one of sexual activity. Again, concern that the vaccine would be a license for sexual activity, but a number of studies have shown that the decision to have sex or not to have sex is really made almost entirely independent of whether or not you've been vaccinated.
But when a parent takes their 12 or 13-year-old in to see the doctor, this is one of the things that's...
Sure. And what happens is that girls tend to be vaccinated at a somewhat older age than boys. And I think that, again, parents' perceptions about when people become sexually active probably have a role in that.
Right. Steve, you had an HPV-related cancer. Can you describe your experience for us?
Well, I think the two things I remember about learning that I had this kind of cancer was first something that hasn't come up here today, which this is a very treatable cancer. The success rate is extremely high. And the second was what Dr. Lowe said earlier, that the infection can occur when you're very young and the cancer can occur when you're very old, which is something that I told my wife repeatedly and had my physician tell her as well. The fact that it's so treatable was immensely reassuring, but it also became probably one of the points of the greatest tension I had as a patient trying to decide what treatment to have. Because as I've learned in this experience, medicine is terrific at advancing treatments. It's not so good at backing off of them when they realize that they don't need to bring all their artillery to a particular cancer.
So what happened?
Well, the consequences of the standard protocol, which is upwards of 90% successful, as I understand it, is still heavily based on radiation therapy that in itself can have morbidities and consequences. Radiologists have gotten far better at controlling them, but there are still possibilities of losing your ability to swallow and being confined to a feeding tube, dry mouth, permanent dry mouth, future bone cancers in the jaw. It's just not something you want to have if you can avoid it. So when you're faced with a, now physicians are sort of arguing amongst themselves on, well, we can sort of avoid this, we can back off this, but there's always the constant pushback of, but we're so successful, we can really almost assure patients that they're going to survive. It's very difficult to come back and say, well, we're less sure about this one, but you have, you know, you'll have a greater quality of life. So that was a difficult decision to make. I ended up going with a fairly experimental protocol that avoided radiation entirely and had a three courses of chemotherapy followed by surgical, robotic surgical removal of the tumor at the deep base of my tongue and a neck resection that took out 80 or so lymph nodes.
How'd you make that decision?
It was difficult. a lot of consultation with friends and family, a lot of sort of shoe leather journalism where I, you know, kind of went beyond maybe what some patients feel comfortable doing and finding out the state of the art in other places. And finally, just kind of deciding to trust the physicians who at GW who said, we have a lot of faith in this. And there's a backup. If we don't feel like we've been successful, then we'll bring in follow-up radiation, and you can sort of count yourself among the cohort that can count on 90% success.
Yeah, when we first identified HPV as a cause of head and neck cancer, we looked at the incidence rates in the United States at that time and discovered that there was a dramatic increase in incidence rates of this cancer in young men. Then we found that the single greatest determinant of whether or not you lived or died after a diagnosis of head and neck cancer was the HPV status of your tumor. So that if your tumor is HPV positive, your risk of dying is reduced by over half. So we recognized that we had this young group of individuals in their 40s who were being diagnosed and treated with a very aggressive regimen, and that they were largely expected to survive from their cancer. And so for the first time as a head and neck cancer treating physician, we saw patients who had the opportunity to live with the consequences of that treatment. So for the last 15 years, we've been really trying to see, can we back off on the intensity of the therapy and reduce both the acute and long-term toxicities of the therapy? Tomorrow will be the first publication of our first efforts in that, the report of the first randomized phase 3 trial exclusive to patients with this disease. We reported the data at ASTRO recently, so I can discuss a little bit of it. The standard of care has been high doses of radiation and high doses of chemotherapy that can leave you with quite a few long-term consequences of treatment. So a targeted molecular therapy that targeted epidermal growth factor receptor became available for head and neck cancers in the U.S. in 2006. So we tried to see if we could replace the high toxic cisplatin regimen with a lower, potentially lower toxic regimen with this drug called cetuximab. And unfortunately, the results showed that cetuximab was inferior to the cisplatin, that the cisplatin really did improve survival. Local control rates prevented recurrence, but unfortunately was more toxic. So our first foray into the de-escalation, unfortunately, was didn't have the results we'd hoped for. But we have more studies going on now with regard to trying to reduce chemotherapy or use immunotherapy instead of chemotherapy and lower doses of radiation or different types of radiation. So we're still hopeful. There's a lot of work still going on. But one other thing that we're discovering is when the epidemic first started, it was largely in young men. As that birth cohort has aged over the last 20 years, we're seeing that there is a shift going on in terms of, it used to be a disease largely in 40-year-old, 50-year-old men. Now as that cohort of men is aging, we're seeing that shift, so we're gonna see a lot more patients diagnosed with this cancer in their 60s and 70s.
Hmm. Steve, do you have any lasting side effects?
Almost none.
That's great.
Some
That's
reason
great.
Switched from scotch to bourbon. That's the only thing. But I have some numbness where the neck resection was that'll probably never go away that I've long ago stopped noticing. Other than that, I can't think of anything. I swallow perfectly dry pills, you know, when I probably shouldn't. My voice didn't change. My hair grew back. And so 3 years on, it feels very much like a past event.
Oh, that's fantastic. That's great.
So radiation obviously has been used successfully in curing over 90% of patients that are treated with HPV-related malignancies of all types because it's a very sensitive type of cancer to radiation. And the dose escalation that we've historically used is one of the reasons for the success, but we're trying now to do much more targeted therapies. So a lot of press has been given to proton therapy, and new centers are opening fairly frequently on an annual basis. We see new locations coming on, but proton therapy has the ability to tailor the treatment and stop the actual radiation dose delivery before it hits the normal tissue. So some of the studies going on now are exactly where in the parotid gland the causes of xerostomia, so can we actually avoid treating? And we have research ongoing right now looking at the spatial distribution as seen on imaging and avoiding treating those portions of the parotid because proton therapy can be so precise. That, of course, is a benefit up front for patients that do need it, do need the radiation therapy, which is currently the standard of care in all head and neck cancer, primarily most oropharynx related cancers. But we certainly see the advantages of proton therapy in reducing the normal tissue toxicities to the not only the parotid but also submandibular glands, neck scarring, things like that.
We've talked a lot about head and neck cancers. What about cervical cancer? What's the prevalence of cervical cancer in the U.S. and the rest of the world and treatment?
So there, obviously we talked about there being a 50-year decline in the incidence of cervical cancer, but it's really plateaued over the past 20 years where we have about 14,000 women. There's actually been a slight increase in the past 5 years from about 12,000 to 14,000 per year being diagnosed. And some of that is lack of vaccination, but also lack of screening. So the women that are diagnosed are generally young women who are not keeping up with their annual pap smears. I see a lot of women, there's a bimodal distribution, so there are young women and older women that are diagnosed with cervical cancer. And the younger women, are young mothers who are working and just don't have time to go to the doctors themselves. They're getting, their children to the doctor, but not really making the effort to go through routine screening. So it's really about empowering women to feel that, and understanding that screening is essential to understanding that cervical cancer does occur in 30-year-olds, 40-year-olds. And the time off from work and the consequences to their family of having to go through treatment is pretty dramatic. So being able to treat them curatively with radiation is very important. But it means that they go through daily radiation with both external techniques and then very precise or pinpointed treatment with what we call brachytherapy, which is an internal radiation that's given directed kind of to the center of the tumor rather than to the entire region. And so because we've been using brachytherapy successfully and we've now developed newer techniques with advanced imaging to look exactly at where the tumor's located, we're able to bring 98%+ of women with stage 1 and 2 cervical cancer to cure.
Dr. Lowy, please go ahead.
I'd like to make two relevant comments. First, when it comes to the vaccine, there has been some theoretical concern that women who have been vaccinated might go for their cervical cancer screening less frequently. But that has actually not been borne out in practice thus far in the United States. But it's very important, even though the vaccine can protect against much of the cancer-causing infections, not all of them. So it's very important for women to continue screening. The other aspect is that the NCI is supporting research to try to improve the diagnostic and precision of cervical cancer screening, and also in principle to try to bring screening to women rather than women to the screening. through self-sampling. This is not yet FDA approved, but I think that this is something that in the next few years might lead to FDA approval and might have an impact on reducing what tends to be this plateau in terms of about 13 or 14,000 cases per year.
Australia has launched a campaign to rid the whole country of HPV-related cancers. Is that a real possibility?
Yeah, Australia is a high adopter country. They have basically provided vaccine free to women and now also to men. And so their uptake of the vaccine has been substantially higher than in the United States. And the current version of the vaccine, the 9-valent vaccine, or Gardasil 9, can protect against about 90% of the cancer-causing infections. And the and Australia is anticipating that at some point in the future, with high uptake of the vaccine, that the vast majority of those kinds of infections simply will not occur, and the cancers caused by those infections will not occur.
Here's a Twitter question. David asks us, how should young adults who are already sexually active decide whether to get the vaccine? And he's talking about people in his 20s, 30s, and 40s. Anyone?
Sure. Well, I think it's important to recognize that with the new vaccine, Gardasil 9, the probability that someone is already who is already sexually active has already been exposed to all the types, all 9 types in the HPV vaccine is low. That's why individuals up to age 26 can still benefit from the vaccine. The FDA approved vaccination up to age 45, but we're still waiting to hear from the CDC as to whether or not they're going to expand the recommended age range. But it's common practice, for instance, in gynecologic offices for women who are getting treated for cervical dysplasia, if they haven't been vaccinated, the gynecologist will vaccinate them because it will protect that individual from infection by other HPV types, not in their specific lesion.
Mm-hmm. Okay. We have a few minutes, so I'm just cautioning everybody. What is the future? Where's the research going? And what is the future of this disease? Is this something that we can rid our society of completely? Is it something that we're just going to have to learn to live with and treat and screen? Or perhaps there are new drugs on the horizon for us?
Well, my sense is that if you're talking about HPV-associated cancer, there really are kind of two different stories. One is for adults, and the other is for young adolescents and people who come after them. The vaccines are going to take care of the vast majority of the disease, and so in the future, I don't think we will need to worry about them, providing we have reasonable uptake of the vaccine. On the other hand, because there's such a very long interval between the time you get vaccinated, get infected, and then develop the cancers are going to be with us for a long time. The increase that we've seen in oropharynx cancer over the last 25 or 30 years, it's the prediction is that it will continue to increase for the foreseeable future. Eventually, it will go down. So it's really important for us to think about how can we improve the treatment now that we have, if you will, proof of principle, the vast majority of people who develop these cancers can be successfully treated. How can we reduce side effects, short-term and long-term? And one way of doing that is with thinking about the genes from the virus that are expressed in the tumor and trying to target those genes. There is some early evidence that actually Dr. Gillison was involved in showing that if you target two of those genes, along with more standard immunotherapy, that this may actually prove beneficial and may have lower side effects. It's not yet FDA approved. You need to do more studies that are controlled, et cetera. We hope if those studies are carried out, they will be positive. But as you heard from Dr. Gillison, the first effort turned out to be negative.
And are these therapies, Dr. Viswanathan, therapies and treatments and screening, are they all available abroad? Or are we in a much better position here? Is the vaccine available abroad?
The vaccine is available globally. I think that the treatments themselves may or may not be available depending on the country. But in developed countries, you know, radiation is available. But there are still many, many countries where it's not. Same thing goes for chemotherapy. There is a WHO list with chemotherapies. And so we hope that people are able to get
So developing countries, this is still a big challenge.
It is. Low and middle income countries.
Yeah. As Dr. Gillison mentioned, you know, about 90% of cervical cancer deaths occur in the developing world. And if you, a way to think about it is that one woman in three who develops cervical cancer in the United States will die from it, whereas two women in three who develop it in the developing world are going to die from it, and many more women in the developing world will get it.
So we have to get the vaccine.
So basically, 250,000 women per year in the developing world will die from this, and without further intervention, the estimate is that there'll be about a 40% increase every 15 years in the number of women dying from this cancer.
Steve, I'm going to let you have the last word here. If a friend came to you and said, "I think I might have this," how would you guide them? What would you say?
That has happened so many times since I published that article. not just friends. I always say, take heart that cancer is a terrible word, but this is a very treatable disease. If you think you have it, you should certainly go check right away. I was on the phone to my doctor within minutes of finding a lump when I was shaving, and I don't know why I was so scared of it, but I was.
And there was no doubt in your mind that this was an unusual lump?
Well, there was no doubt that that was a very weird thing to find on my neck. So, I can't explain why I was more concerned about that than other strange things that happened to me. But, and the other is that something that I learned during this experience was that the cancer staging system, where I was diagnosed with stage 4 carcinoma, and I didn't quite know what stage 4 was, but I knew there was no stage 5, was really, and has since been adjusted, as I understand
it. Yeah, this year.
So this disease is so treatable that that conventional staging system doesn't apply very accurately. And with the changes, as I've talked to my physician, I would now have been diagnosed with stage 1, which would have been a much nicer thing to hear. so I try to play the role of being very reassuring that, you know, the treatment is no fun, no matter what you choose, but it's a curable cancer and, you know, life goes on.
Terrific. Thank you. He wrote a beautiful story and he stopped 10 seconds before the allotted time. So that's all we have time for. I want to thank everybody for this great discussion. Thank you for being here with us, and we'll move on to our next panel.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. To hear more interviews from this series and other Washington Post Live programs, visit us at washingtonpostlive.com.